Welcome to the 13 Skulls, a journey into a world that is just beyond our comprehension, the world of the paranormal.
Welcome to the 13 Skulls. In this episode, we're going to be taking a look at the U.S. military paying SETI to look for alien life, the Pendle Witch's Cottage, an alien base that's supposedly on the inside of a crater on the moon, the Earth Mother figurine, the Japanese Hotel for the Dead, the Poor Man's Guide to Survival Gear, and a naval UFO drone. That and a lot more in this 65th episode of the 13 Skulls.
Night on Christmas Eve, I was dreaming of the soft white snow. I was awoken by a noise near the Christmas tree. What it was, I did not know. It was Santa Claus, he was bringing me some gifts. Unfortunately, I did not know that.
I didn't know.
So I quietly snuck up behind him, and I shot him 5 times in the back. It went pow, 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 pow. He said, "What the fuck? Ow, ow, ow." Then I shot him 3 more times in the head. Pieces of his brain flew out, and he was dead. That's when I noticed his blood-soaked beard and his red suit filled with bullet holes. I said, "Oh my God, I killed Santa Claus. I'm not going to jail for this, asshole."
Hell no.
So I went to my shed and I got my saw, and I started to choppity-chop-chop.
Chop-chop-chop.
I started with his arms, then his legs, then his head, and then the torso was a really long job. And the blood went spurt, spurt, spurt. It was really hard work, work, work. It was hard cutting through his spine. I must have vomited 16 times. I burned all the pieces in my fireplace. The smell of burning human flesh filled my nose.
Sizzle, sizzle.
11 hours later, there was nothing left. And that's when I heard my telephone. It was Auntie Jean looking for Uncle Bob. She said he left the house dressed as Santa Claus, but he didn't come home last night. Have you seen him? God, I hope he's all right.
Well, welcome back, everybody, and Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to all of you who aren't celebrating Christmas, but Merry Christmas to those of you who are. In this episode, we got quite a good amount of stuff to talk about, but really, this is going to be kind of a quick episode because I didn't have a whole lot of time to search for a lot of stuff with Christmas coming up. It's just been really busy, but let's go ahead and get on with the show, the search for extraterrestrial life. The U.S. military is paying SETI to check Kepler-22b for alien life. It's announced that it's back in business, SETI that is, checking out the new habitable exoplanets recently discovered by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope to see if they might be home to alien civilizations. The cash needed to restart SETI's efforts has come in part from the U.S. Air Force Space Command, who are interested in using the organization's detection instruments for space situational awareness. "This is a superb opportunity for SETI observations," said Jill Tarter, the director of the Center for SETI Research. In a statement issued, she said, "For the first time, we can point our telescopes at the stars and know that those stars actually host planetary systems, including at least one that begins to approximate an Earth analog in the habitable zone around its host star. That's the type of world that might be home to a civilization capable of building radio transmitters." NASA has just announced the discovery of many exoplanets orbiting other stars by its Kepler spacecraft, including the world Kepler-22b, which is being described as Earth's twin by the space agency. It orbits a sun-like G-type star some 600 light-years away at a distance that could have liquid water. Intriguingly, SETI notes that its resurgence and new mission of examining the Kepler-discovered planetary systems is partially funded by the U.S. military. The restart of SETI work at the ATA has been made possible thanks to the interest and generosity of the public who support SETI research via the SETIstars.org website. Additional funds necessary for observatory reactivation and operations are being provided by the United States Air Force as part of a formal assessment of the instrument's utility for space situational awareness. Could it be that the Pentagon are doing something useful for once and making sure that if there are any potentially hostile alien civilizations out there, that they'll find out early on? Well, not likely. In fact, Space Command are much more concerned about tracking satellites in Earth orbit and consider that the innovative Allen Array could be handy in picking up transmissions from spacecraft so as to help the existing military space surveillance network keep a handle on where they are. Should SETI detect signs of radio-using life at any of the newly pinpointed potentially habitable star systems, Space Command will probably be very glad they helped to fund the restart of SETI. There's not much more to this article here, but I just thought it was really interesting that the military is wanting SETI to look for alien life. I mean, is it just because they want to utilize their system just to see if there is anything out there? Or is there some kind of underlying reason as to why? Does the military know that there's something there and they're using SETI to simply just keep an eye out so they don't have to use their resources for it? I don't know, but I just thought it was really interesting. Let's go ahead and move on to something that's courtesy of telegraph.co.uk. A teenage boy was eaten alive by piranhas after leaping into a river that was infested with the flesh-eating fish. This happened in Bolivia, according to officials. The 18-year-old man was drunk when he jumped out of a canoe in the Bolivian town of Rosario del Yada, 400 miles or 640 kilometers north of the capital of La Paz. The man bled to death after the attack, which occurred last Thursday. First word of the incident emerged on Tuesday when it was reported by the local Urbal radio station. Police suspect that the man had committed suicide because he was a fisherman in the region and knew the river well. Despite their fearsome reputation, fatal attacks by piranhas on humans are very rare. There's nothing else to this article here, but I just thought, man, that is a horrible, horrible, bad way to commit suicide if that's what you're going to do. You know, why would you do that? I mean, the piranhas aren't very big anyway, so to commit suicide that way is got to be torturous. So, you know, sometimes people amaze me with what they're capable of and why they would do something. To me, this almost sounds more like homicide in a way instead of suicide, but was weird to say the least. So anyway, let's go ahead and move on to another article, which is courtesy of dailymail.co.uk. In the past, I have seen some very strange phenomena when it comes to raining something other than water. Rain happens all the time, and raining strange things happens a lot, but this particular incident is something I've never heard of before. I've seen it rain frogs before or tadpoles. A very odd thing. After a series of storm warnings, drivers in the evening rush hour were prepared for almost anything, except for it to start raining apples. Scores of them battered car roofs and windshields before landing in the road at a busy junction in Coventry. The deluge of fruit brought traffic to a standstill at 6:45 on Monday. A 20-yard stretch of the B4098 was left strewn with green slush after the incident. One motorist who was traveling with her husband said the apples fell out of nowhere. They were small and green and hit the bonnet hard. Everyone had to stop their cars suddenly. The phenomenon is believed to have been down to a mini tornado which touched down elsewhere, sucking up apples from the ground and from trees. Such a powerful vacuum could have traveled for many miles before the tornado's energy dissipated. Another theory is that the apples could have fallen from the hold of a plane. Brian Meekins, who's 63, was stunned when he opened his front door and found his garden full of smashed apples. The retired forklift driver said, "At first I assumed kids must have thrown them because we do get occasional egg and apples thrown, but there are too many for that." Jim Dale, a senior meteorologist from British Weather Services, said that the event was probably caused by returning polar maritime air. Essentially, these events are caused when a vortex of air, kind of like a mini tornado, lifts things off the ground, rising up into the atmosphere until the air around it causes them to fall to Earth again. Returning polar maritime air is such an unstable condition, and it basically means air returning from the polar regions, which is very unstable. We've all heard fish and frogs falling from the sky, which honestly I have, and apples is certainly unusual because they have some weight to them, but it's not out of the realms of possibility. The Met Office yesterday warned that a storm expected to hit the south coast tonight and tomorrow would bring up to 70-mile-an-hour winds lashing seafronts along the coastline. It's just an odd thing because I have seen some rather strange stuff in my life, but I've never quite seen it rain apples because apples, you know, there's a picture of a guy there, Dave Meekin, who I was talking about earlier, holding one of the apples that fell to the ground. And there's, you know, pictures there of the apples too, but these apples are fairly good sized. And, you know, to have that kind of weight be pulled up, it's just fascinating. I really found it to be really, really odd. Now, this next thing that I wanted to talk about is something that I heard on the Rue Morgue radio show. You can find them at RueMorgue.com. I think it's Rue-Morgue.com. Great show. You need to subscribe to it if you're a horror fan. If you like horror movies, you know, Night of the Living Dead, that kind of thing. If you like horror movies, then this is the way to go. You really need to check them out. It's a great show. Well, I heard this the other day. It's called FixTheChapel.com. It's the Evans City Cemetery Chapel. It's the place where Night of the Living Dead was originally filmed, the original one, the George Romero film that originally came out. This was the chapel that was in that movie, and they're getting ready to demolish it, as far as I know, and they're getting ready to build something else over top of it, I think. But they're having a fundraiser to keep that from happening. So you can visit fixthechapel.com. There is a donate button there that you can donate, media, that, you know, all the different things that you can go and check it out. But if you like horror movies and you don't want to see this place demolished, then you need to go to this site and donate as much as you can. You know, hopefully that'll help at least to some degree. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of dailymail.co.uk. A photographer took a picture at the Hodge Close Quarry, and it looks like a skull in the reflection. There's a cave there with some rocks that are falling down. You can see where they've just, you know, kind of broken apart off a cliff face or something. And this little body of water there, there's this little small lake. And if you turn the picture sideways, it looks like a skull. It's a very odd-looking picture, but it's really quite beautiful if you take a look at it. The lake at the abandoned slate quarry is supposedly, from what everybody's saying, eerie enough. But as the image shows, if you turn your head, you're greeted with a terrifying sight of a giant skull. The image was taken by a diver who had just been in the waters at the quarry near the Coniston in Cumbria. The pool is accessed through a 25-meter-long and 2-meter-square tunnel. The spot, which is popular to divers, has claimed the lives of at least three over the years. Photographer Peter Bardsley said, "Have a look at this photograph. It's taken at a slate quarry called Hodge Close near Coniston on the Lake District. Divers have died here in the underwater tunnels, and climbers have fallen to their deaths. The reflection, when turned 90 degrees, shows a skull. It's not been manipulated in any way and is very spooky," according to the man who took the picture, Peter Bardsley. There's not much more to the article there. There's a little bit, but it doesn't really reference anything important. What you need to do is just go take a look at the picture. And if you can't go take a look at the picture, let me do a little bit of describing for it. What you're going to see is a picture, you know, somebody was apparently standing at the edge of this little lake and, you know, looking across and took the picture. Well, off to the left, you'll see this round cave. It kind of looks like the rocks are, you know, strewn across in the middle of the picture from, like I said, it looks like they've broken apart and fallen off of a cliff face. But the reflection, even if it's turned sideways, does look like a skull. But, you know, the water is smooth, it's clear, the water's actually kind of dark, but it looks fairly clear. And, you know, if you were to go down in it, it looks like it was actually, you know, you could see a good distance, but the reflection is kind of smoky, you know, a little bit of mist around, it looks kind of damp and dark there. And you can see the reflection off of it. It's actually reflecting the circle that is the tunnel that leads into this cave. It actually looks like a skull. It's a really wild thing. I want you guys to go and take a look at it. And just the way that the rocks are strewn, it actually looks like this thing has teeth to it. It's just a wild picture, a very odd one. I love skulls, so this automatically caught my interest and I wanted to put it into the show. So go check it out. It's a really interesting picture of the reflection of what is a skull cave. All right, well, this next article is courtesy of FirstCoastNews.com. Something that I've not really heard much of before, but someone was unparalyzed by a crash. It might sound like the plot right out of a TV movie, but a woman was paralyzed since the age of 13 and miraculously regains feelings in her legs and is able to walk again after being injured in a traffic accident. That's exactly what happened to 27-year-old Monique Vandervoorst. It happened to her almost 2 years ago. Vandervoorst had turned to hand cycling after losing feeling in her legs as a teen. 2 years ago, while she was on the road training for the 2012 Paralympics, Vandervoorst was mowed down by a speeding bicyclist. While in the hospital after the collision, Vandervoorst said she suddenly developed a tingling in her legs, and within a year, she was walking again. This week, the announcement came that she joined a pro cycling team and was looking forward to competing at the Olympics this next year. Vandervoorst's doctors haven't been able to come up with an explanation for her miraculous recovery, and neither could any of the doctors interviewed by MSNBC. With the caveat that it's impossible to comment on a specific patient without seeing actual medical records, physicians agreed that it was unlikely that anyone who had lost feelings in their lower extremities could be healed by being hit hard in an accident. Well, according to this, she actually did. I mean, if she hadn't gotten into the wreck, would she have been able to get her feeling back anyway? You know, it's kind of one of those things where had it happened or had it not happened, would you have still gotten the same outcome? I don't know. But either way, there's a little bit more here to this article that you can read about what happened to her. But there's really not much more information that's really pertinent to it that you can, you know, get out of it more than what I just said. But either way, I just thought it was really interesting that this woman was paralyzed and now all of a sudden she can walk again after being in an accident. It's just a really, it's a wild thing. So let's go ahead and move on to the next article, which is courtesy of news.sky.com. A witch's cottage has been unearthed in Lancashire. A cottage believed to be linked to the witches of Pendle and a mummified cat have been unearthed by workmen in Lancashire. The site, described by one archaeologist as Lancashire's Pompeii, was discovered during a construction project. Water engineers found the 17th century cottage during excavations near the Lower Black Moss Reservoir in Pendle, and now experts think that it could be connected to the famous Pendle witches, especially as a mummified cat was found sealed into one of the walls. It's thought that the cat may have been entombed in the wall while still alive, possibly in the 19th century, as paranormal protection. Simon Entwistle, an expert on the Pendle witches, said, "Cats feature prominently in the folklore about witches. Whoever consigned this cat to such a horrible fate was clearly seeking protection from evil spirits. We're just a few months away from the 400th anniversary of the Pendle witch trials, and here we have an incredibly rare find, which could well be the famous Malkin Tower. The tower was said to be the site of a notorious meeting between the witches on Good Friday of 1612. Carl Sanders, United Utilities project manager, said, "It's not often you come across a fairy tale cottage complete with a witch's cat. The building is in remarkable condition. You can walk through it and get a real sense that you're peering into the past. Pendle Hill has a real aura about it, and it's not hard to be affected by the place." Frank Geico from NP Archaeology led the team which unearthed the Pendle building. He said, "It's like discovering your own little Pompeii. We rarely get the opportunity to work with something so well preserved. As soon as we get started digging, we find the tops of doors, and we knew we were into something special. The building is a microcosm for the rise and fall of the area, from the time of the Pendle witches to the Industrial Age. There are layers of local history right before our eyes. The building also contains many 19th century artifacts, such as crockery, a cooking range, and a bedstead." The United Utilities engineering project has been put on hold while the archaeologists complete their investigation of the site. There's actually a couple pictures here of the site. You know, you can actually see the stove, the cooking places that they were talking about, and a lot of the rock walls that they had for the building itself. It's a really fascinating thing, especially considering that this place could be many, many, many years old. It's just a very fascinating thing to me. You know, I know it's not very Christmassy to be talking about this kind of stuff, but honestly, this is really fascinating to me. I find this kind of stuff really interesting and just thought I had to put it into the show. So go check out the Pendle Witch's Cottage. Let's go ahead and move on to another article, which is courtesy of beforeitsnews.com. Apparently, according to this article, there is an alien base that has been confirmed inside of a crater on the moon. There's not much to the article here as far as reading, but there is a video there that you can go and take a look at that actually has John Lear and Carrie Cassidy from the Project Camelot. It's an interview from 2009 that you can see about this crater with this supposed moon base in there. Personally, I don't really think that it's true. It could be faked big time. It could be a hoax. You never know. But the interview from John Lear and Carrie Cassidy is fairly interesting, and I want you guys to go and take a look at it. Supposedly, it's a 29-mile-wide nuclear reactor that's on the moon. I want you guys to go and take a look at it. Watch the video. The one video that you're going to see up at the top is roughly somewhere in the area of about, well, for some reason, I can't get it to actually play. I know I watched it the other day, and I want to say it was somewhere in the area of about 9 minutes long. But there's another video down at the bottom. It's a YouTube video that's about 4 minutes, 22 seconds long that you can go and hear this interview. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on to, since I can't get the videos to work, let's go ahead and move on to another article, which is courtesy of YNetNews.com. It's something that was sent to me by Miles out there at Facebook land, but it was also something that I came across somewhere else too. It's just a fascinating thing. Experts are being stumped by ancient markings. Israeli diggers who uncovered complex rooms carved into bedrock in oldest section of Jerusalem find three V-shaped cuts next to each other. Mysterious stone carvings made thousands of years ago and recently uncovered in an excavation underneath Jerusalem have archaeologists stumped. The V shapes are cut next to each other into the limestone floors in one of the rooms, about 2 inches deep and about 20 inches long. There were no finds to offer any clues pointing to the identity of who made them or what purpose they served. The archaeologist in charge of the dig knows so little that they have been unable to even posit a theory about their nature. This is according to Eli Shukron, who is one of the directors of the dig. The markings are very strange and very intriguing. I've never seen anything like them, said Shukron. The shapes were found in a dig known as the City of David, a politically sensitive excavation conducted by Israeli government archaeologists and funded by a nationalist Jewish group under the Palestinian neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem. The rooms were unearthed as part of the excavation of fortifications around the ancient city's only natural water source, the Gihon Spring. It is possible, the dig's archaeologists say, that when the markings were made at least 2,800 years ago, the shapes might have accommodated some sort of wooden structure that stood inside them, or they might have served as some other purpose on their own. They might have had a ritual function, or one that was entirely mundane. Archaeologists faced by a curious artifact can usually at least some venture a guess about its nature, but in this case, no one can, including outside experts consulted by Shukron and the dig's co-director. Archaeologists with decades of experience between them have no idea. There appears to be at least one other ancient marking of the same type at the site. A century-old map of the expedition led by the British explorer Montague Parker, who searched for the lost treasure of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem between 1909 and 1911, includes the shape of a V drawn in an underground channel not far away. Modern archaeologists haven't excavated that area yet. The purpose of the complex is part of the riddle. The straight lines of the walls and level floors are evidence of careful engineering, and it was located close to the most important part of the city. A unique find in a room beside the one with the markings, a stone like a modern grave marker, which was left upright when the room was filled in, might offer a clue. Some stones were used in the ancient Middle East as a focal point for a ritual or a memorial for the dead ancestors, and it's more likely a remnant of a pagan religion which the city's Israelite prophets tried to eradicate. It's the first such stone to be found intact in Jerusalem excavations, but the ritual stone does not necessarily mean the whole complex was a temple. It might simply have a marker corner devoted to the religious practice in a building whose purpose was commonplace. So, in other words, there's a little bit more to this article here, but in other words, they really don't know what this is for, and they're really just speculating. Now, there's a picture here of the V-shaped markings that they're talking about. There's two that are facing in one direction, and another one in the middle facing a different direction. So you have two, let's say two facing up and one facing down. The one facing down is above the two that are facing up and in between them. Their top points, the one solid top point, are facing each other and about even with each other. But it's really hard to tell what they could have been used for. And if there's no clue, I mean, honestly, you can speculate that they could have been for anything. Either way, I just thought it was really neat. And I want you guys to go and take a look at it. Now, there's something that I came across the other day that I wanted to point you guys in the direction of. It's courtesy of smashwords.com. It's an ebook called Clouds of Thunder. It's a book basically about Thunderbirds, and you can download it. It's free. It's nothing for you to have to pay for. You can go and read it on, you know, you can look at it as a PDF or, you know, a document for palm reading devices or just plain text, online reading, Kindle version. There's all kinds of different things there. But basically, it's a fiction book about Thunderbirds. I thought it was really neat. I'm giving it a read. I want you guys to go and check it, check it out and take a look at it and read it. You never know, it might actually be really good. I'll let you know what I think of it. But so far, you know, I haven't really had a chance to, but it was published in 2010, and it looks like it could be really good. So go check it out. It's called Clouds of Thunder, and you can find it in the show notes. I'll post a link up to it so you guys can, you know, go and check it out for yourself. Now, this next article is courtesy of archaeologydaily.com. It's the Earth Mother figurine. French archaeologists have discovered an extremely rare example of a Neolithic, quote-unquote, Earth Mother figurine on the banks of the River Somme. The 6,000-year-old statuette is 8 inches high with imposing buttocks and hips, but stubby arms and a cone-like head. Similar figurines have been found before in Europe, but rarely so far north and seldom in such a complete and well-preserved condition. The Lady of Villers-Carbonel, as she has been named, can make two claims to be an Earth Mother. She was fired from local earth or clay and closely resembles figurines with similar stylized female bodies found around the Mediterranean. Although Neolithic experts are revising their opinions, the figurines have long been believed to have been connected with the existence of a cult which worshipped a goddess of the hearth or of fertility. The Somme, quote-unquote, Earth Mother, appears to have been broken into 5 or 6 parts while she was being fired between 4300 and 3600 BC. She was found in the ruins of a Neolithic kiln at a French government preventive archaeological dig near Villers-Carbonel on the banks of the River Somme in the department of the same name. The figurine may just be the beginning of a vast archaeological harvest in northern France in the next few years. The French government's preventive archaeology agency, INRAP, has been given permission and the funds to explore 77 sites along the 60-mile course of the new 50-mile-wide Seine Nord Europe Canal for ocean-going barges linking the River Seine to Belgium and the River Rhine. The archaeologist in charge of the Villers-Carbonel dig, Francois Boyston, told The Independent that the statuette is very beautiful and remarkably preserved. We sometimes find fragments of such statuettes, but rarely the whole figurine. The Earth Mother of the Somme may owe her survival, paradoxically, to the fact that she was broken while being made. Her various pieces were discovered in a collapsed kiln or oven. Miss Boston said that the stylized figurine, with inflated buttocks and thighs and rudimentary head and arms, closely resembled similar figurines from the period found as far away as the Middle East. Could the Lady of Villers-Carbonel represent the Neolithic ideal of female beauty long before the coming of fashion magazines, airbrushes, and Photoshop? Possibly, you never know. But it could just be someone trying to recreate what they thought was a beautiful woman. But it also could have some kind of, like I said, Earth Mother kind of representation for what they thought the Mother of the Earth would have looked like, or possibly even just what, you know, again, like I said, what someone thought was a beautiful woman. You never know. Was this some kind of Neolithic pornography? I mean, you never know. It could have been used for anything. You never know. It could have just been something that, again, was just something someone thought was fun to make. You never know. They seem like they don't even really know what it was for. But anyway, let's go ahead and take a break here. When we get back, we're going to be taking a look at something else that is rather creepy. Japan's Hotel for the Dead. We're also going to be taking a look at a Saudi woman who was beheaded for being a witch, and UFO drone. It's really wild. So you guys stay put. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is reality. Welcome to my beautiful nightmare.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Let's go ahead and move on to an article courtesy of archaeologydaily.com again. Apparently, there have been some of the earliest known human beds that have been found in South Africa. Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, said Benjamin Franklin. Well, that may have held true a couple of hundred years ago, but when it comes to our ancient human ancestors, researchers don't know much about how or even where they slept. Now a team working in South Africa claims to have found the earliest known sleeping mats made of plant material and dated to 77,000 years ago, 50,000 years earlier than previous evidence for human bedding. These early mattresses apparently were even specially prepared to be resistant to mosquitoes and other insects. Over the past several years, the team has found that many of the archaeological layers featured large 1 centimeter thick swaths of plant remains, including the remnants of both stems and leaves. Most of them cover at least 3 square meters. The team suspected that these swaths were the remains of bedding. But the earliest previous evidence for sleeping mats is only about 20 to 30,000 years old at sites in Spain, South Africa, and Israel, where similar but more fragmentary arrangements of plants have been found. So to be sure, the researchers put the remains under the microscope. Reporting online in the journal Science, Lynn Wadley, an archaeologist at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, said her and her colleagues described the results of 2 sophisticated archaeological techniques: analysis of phytoliths, tiny fossil plant remains, which also allow identification of plant species, and micromorphology, the high-resolution examination of archaeological remains. The team found that the swaths, which dated from 77,000 to 58,000 years ago, were made from sedges, rushes, and grasses, plants that grow down to the Tongati River but are not found in the dry rock shelter. Thus, the people of Sibidu must have gathered them deliberately and brought them to the cave. Under the microscope, blocks of the plant material showed signs of compression and repeated trampling. In the earliest layer, 77,000 years ago, the team found the leaves of Cryptocoria woodi, also known as Cape Laurel, or the bastard camphor tree, an aromatic plant whose leaves are used in traditional medicines even today. The leaves contain several chemical compounds that can kill insects, and the team suggests that the early humans chose them to protect against malaria-carrying mosquitoes and other pests. Now, there's quite a bit more to this article here. I just thought it was really interesting that they found these early beddings. I love archaeology. I love science. I'm really intrigued by it all, and especially something that goes against the grain of a lot of the beliefs that people have for how long humans have been here. For them to have said that they found these and that they're 77,000 years old is just fascinating to me. It really is. You know, are they really that old? You know, can carbon dating and other scientific processes really show you the true current age of humanity and how long things have actually been here? Or is it, you know, is it just something that they're making a guess at? I don't really know. Either way, I find it to be really fascinating that they found 77,000-year-old bedding. It just makes me wonder how it lasted that long. I mean, 77,000 years, that's kind of hard to even comprehend how long that is. I mean, and to know that this plant material actually lasted that long, it's just absolutely fascinating. So let's go ahead and move on to something a bit more on the creepy side. Japan's Hotel for the Dead. It's courtesy of OddityCentral.com. A hotel for the dead. This one is for real, actual corpses. And it's pretty luxurious, going from the pictures at least. It's a place where you can check in and wait until it's your time to check out, and then you can be cremated. The Hotel Lastel, run by Hisayoshi Teramura in Japan's Yokohama suburbs, looks like any other building from the outside. In fact, young couples mistake it for a regular hotel and come asking for accommodation. But the place is not meant for lovers or for weary travelers, only for those who have already made their final exit from the world. The need for such a hotel very much exists in Japan, where there is a wait time of at least 4 days for a crematorium. With a total of 1.2 million deaths in the country in 2010 alone, the annual death rate is at 0.95%, while the global average is only 0.84%. The Japanese also apparently tend to splurge on funerals, on the cost of flowers, coffins, and other memorial services. The corpses stored at the hotel are placed in refrigerated coffins that cost about 12,000 yen, or approximately $157. They lay there until an opening is available at one of the overworked crematoriums in the city. Apparently, entry into the business is not all that difficult with the absence of mandatory qualifications or licenses. An office and telephone will suffice to get you started. Very odd that you don't even need a license to be doing this. Mr. Terramura, who plans to expand the place, said his second branch will be a bigger space, able to hold up to 40 corpses. His neighbors, however, have not even the slightest inkling that they sleep every night to a group of dead bodies. It actually looks like a fairly nice place. You can go and take a look at one of the rooms that has one of these refrigerated coffins in it, and another one of these, I guess, more of a little chapel. There's seats there that you can sit down and look at the casket, I guess. Look at this refrigerated coffin. But anyway, I just thought it was really creepy that Japan has a hotel for the dead. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to something else, courtesy of dailymail.co.uk. This is something that I've heard other people talking about, and I thought it was really interesting. We might actually get a glimpse of the Ark of the Covenant, and it's all because of a leaky roof. The problem of a leaky roof could be about to give the world the chance to glimpse the legendary Ark of the Covenant. That's because the claimed home of the iconic relic, a small chapel in Ethiopia, has sprung a leak, and so the Ark could be now on the move. The Ark, which the Bible says holds God's Ten Commandments given to Moses on Mount Sinai, is said to have been kept in Aksum, in the Chapel of the Tablet, adjacent to St. Mary of Zion Church, since the 1960s. According to the Old Testament, it was first kept in the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem for centuries until Babylonian invasion in the 6th century. Since then, it's been the goal of many adventurers and archaeologists to find it. There has been a long-running claim from the Orthodox Christians of Ethiopia that they have had the Ark for centuries, and since the 1960s, it's apparently been kept in the chapel. No one has been allowed to see the holy object described in Scripture as being made from acacia wood, plated with gold, and topped with two golden angels, except for one solitary elderly monk who must watch over the Ark for the remainder of his life and is never allowed to leave the chapel grounds. But now the chapel has to be covered in a tarp to stop the rain from getting in. The water damage could mean that the Ark could be moved for the first time in decades, giving religious worshippers and adventurers alike a chance to see it. British photographer Tim Makins, who's 54, who is a travel photographer for publications like Lonely Planet, discovered the church had sprung a leak whilst traveling through Ethiopia last September. He believes the moving of the Ark could be one of the best ways to discover if there's any truth to the claims of the East African state. Tim said, "During my most recent visit to the church, I was surprised to see some ground adjacent to the Chapel of the Tablet being cleared and leveled by workmen," which there's a picture here that you can go in and actually see of that, "and some quantities of building stone being assembled nearby. Asking around, I managed to discover that there is a new temporary chapel which is being built, and the Ark is to be moved into it while the original chapel is prepared. It seems that the builders of the 1960s were not as careful as the builders of centuries past, and the roof of the chapel has developed some serious leaks." Tim said that the construction of the new temporary chapel would take about 3 months, according to the workers and religious figures at the site, though he suspects it will probably take much longer. He also said that when the work is finished, the Ark of the Covenant will be carried to its new resting place. That this can be done by one person allowed to see it is unlikely, as the Bible describes the size of the Ark as 2.5 cubits in length, 1.5 in breadth, and 1.5 in height. Cubits in today's measurements translate to about 1.31 meters by 0.79 meters by 0.79 meters and is normally carried on two long wooden poles. If it really is this size and it still contains two stone tablets that list God's commandments, then the elderly monk will no doubt not be able to transfer it on his own. He's going to need to have some help with it. I want to know if the Ark of the Covenant is actually there. There's some pictures of the temple there, of the chapel, that you can go and take a look at. I just thought it was really interesting that they're possibly going to have to move it. And if they do, I wonder what kind of security they're going to have and whether or not you're actually going to be able to have some pictures of it while they're moving it. You know, this would give a lot of religious people, a lot of Christians, a lot of resurgence in their faith, I believe, if they were to actually see that this thing truly exists. But let's go ahead and move on to something, again, a bit more disturbing. Courtesy of news.yahoo.com, a Saudi Arabian woman was beheaded after being convicted of practicing witchcraft and sorcery, according to the Saudi Interior Ministry, which is at least the second such execution for sorcery this year. The woman, Amina bint Abdulhalim Nassar, was executed in the northern Saudi province of Al Jawf on Monday. A source close to the Saudi religious police told Arab newspaper Al Hayat that authorities who searched Nassar's home found a book about witchcraft, 35 veils, and glass bottles full of an unknown liquid used for sorcery among her possessions. According to reports, authorities said Nassar claimed to be a healer and would sell a veil and three bottles for 1,500 riyals or $400. According to the ministry, Nassar's death sentence was upheld by an appeals court in the Saudi Supreme Judicial Council. Philip Luther, the interim director of Amnesty International's Middle East and North Africa program, condemned Nassar's killing, calling it deeply shocking. The charges of witchcraft and sorcery are not defined as crimes in Saudi Arabia, and to use them to subject someone to the cruel and extreme penalty of execution is truly appalling, said Luther. Luther also said that a charge of sorcery is often used by Saudi government as a smokescreen under which they punish people for exercising freedom of speech. Nassar was not the first person to be executed for alleged witchcraft by the Saudi government this year. In September, a Sudanese man, which I believe we talked about in the show, was publicly decapitated with a sword in the city of Medina, which actually, if I can find it, there is a video of it out there. I'll post it if I can find it. You know, you might not want to watch it, but anyway, according to Amnesty International, at least 79 people have been executed in Saudi Arabia so far in 2011, more than three times as many as 2010. The Saudi embassy in Washington did not immediately respond to a request for comment. There's not much more to this article here. I just thought it was really interesting that even today, in this day and age that we live in, granted, I live in the West, you know, we have a different philosophy than what people do in the East, at least some degree anyway, that they're still beheading people for supposedly practicing witchcraft and sorcery. I just thought it was really fascinating. So anyway, let's go to move on to another article, which is courtesy of beforeusnews.com. This is an article that is for all you people out there who are survival people or people who think that maybe possibly the end of the world is coming for 2012. You never know. But anyway, this is the Poor Man's Guide to Survival Gear. Basically, it's just a list of stuff that you need. A bug out bag, camouflage clothing, extreme weather protection, combat boots, camp heaters, survival knives, communication, electricity, you know, survival tent, emergency medical kits, food production, security systems, night vision, self-defense, guns, and all kinds you can go and take a look at that'll explain to you exactly what you might need if the zombies come. Or if World War III, a nuclear fallout comes, if anything like that happens. Or if you just like to go camping and you want to have a lot of survival gear, here you go. It's a list of the poor man's survival guide of what you need if you happen to be in a situation where you need to survive and we don't have the technology that we have anymore. You know, that if all electricity's gone, if you know you don't have what you have now anymore and you have to survive on your own, this will help you get through it if you have all the stuff that's in this list. But let's go ahead and move on to the last things that I wanted to talk about. It's courtesy of naturalplane.blogspot.com and SOT.net. It's a naval drone in Missouri. There's photos here and actual video of a news report of what the people saw when they saw it and what exactly it was. We'll play the audio for you here in just a moment, but supposedly this is a U.S. drone. It looks like a UFO. It just looks really, really odd. But anyway, let's go ahead and take a listen to the news report for that.
It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a UFO. Residents in Cowley County still talking about a mystery craft being seen towed down U.S. 77 yesterday. It was a sight that, for some, won't be forgotten anytime soon.
Sitting inside Lindley's appliance store, Cammie Root is used to seeing large machinery towed down U.S. 77.
Yeah, it sure caught my attention.
But what she saw Monday afternoon is something she won't soon forget.
There was this funny sphere that went through on this big trailer. And my first thought was, That looks like a UFO.
A huge 32-foot craft of some sort, wrapped in tarp and as mysterious as the transport company who called Sheriff Don Reed for help.
They told us that it was an aircraft and that they had explored other ways of transporting it, but this was the best way for them to do it. And they asked us not to say a whole lot about it.
After all, the massive load's shape would certainly draw enough attention on its own.
People were calling in saying, oh, well, they think they found a flying saucer. It looks like a flying saucer to us, and we don't know for sure what it is.
For nearly an hour, officers helped maneuver the craft through Cowley County.
The biggest thing that they had to deal with was down at the roundabout. They had to remove a bunch of signs and markers because the load was so long it couldn't make the corner.
While onlookers struggled to wipe the shock from their faces and the questions from their minds.
What was that funny thing that was on that trailer that looked like, you know, something from somewhere else?
So what in the world was it? Under Sheriff Bill Mueller says it was an experimental aircraft from Northrop Grumman, maybe a new unmanned drone. Still a very cool sight to see, and it's still got a ways to go. Its final destination is Maryland.
Now, according to this article from naturalplane.blogspot.com, it's actually a Northrop Grumman X-47B naval unmanned drone and is, again, en route to Maryland. According to what Lon wrote here, they spoke with officials, and the drone under the tarp and on the trailer is it's a tailless, autonomous, unmanned aircraft developed by the U.S. Unmanned Combat Air System Demonstration Program. It's a demonstration program only, and the drone's being tested for, you know, for technical issues. Now, apparently there is a slight schematic of this thing there on naturalplane.blogspot.com's site for this that I'll post a link up to, that apparently this thing is 62 feet wide and 38 feet long. It's approximately 23.8 feet high. And, it can be up to that whenever the wings are tilted in, and is approximately 10 feet high whenever it's actually at its, its flying height. It can go up to 40,000 feet. It's subsonic. It has a weapons payload of 4,500 pounds, can go 6 hours without refueling, and as far as I can tell here, weighs 44,000 pounds, which seems a bit heavy to me. Maybe I'm reading that wrong, but either way, I just thought it to be really fascinating and wonder why they chose the design that they chose. Why does it look the way that it looks? Why did they go for this specific design? I mean, apparently people have been looking for this quote-unquote saucer-type shape as something that's feasible and can be done and is very aerodynamic for a long time, but this one's just fascinating. I want you guys to go and take a look at it and let me know what you think. Guys and gals, I hate to say this is the end of the show. Let's go ahead and take a little break here, and when we get back, we'll close out the show.
Make up your sound. They try and bring you down. Take you up.
right, y'all, since it is the end of the show, let's go ahead and bury the formalities, get them in the dirt and out of the way. If you have an experience or feedback, you can email me at the13skulls@gmail.com or info@the13skulls.com, or you can call me at 817-986-0019. I will be posting up links to ufoclearinghouse.webs.com. If you like UFO sightings, Manuel out there has a lot of really good stuff coming in all the time. If you want, give me a review in iTunes, or you can listen to the show through Stitcher. If you like the music in the show, some of it is courtesy of the IOTA Promonet at www.iotaalliance.com. The sound effects are courtesy of freesound.org. If you have a podcast, radio show, book, or anything like that, you want to swap promos, please do. I really want to promote as much as I can other people's works. If you are a gearhead like me, again, and you like muscle cars, go check out themusclecarplace.com. It's a great podcast, great website. It's really cool if you like muscle cars. If you want a button or magnet, just email me with your name and an address, and I'll get one out to you as soon as I can. I will, again, post links to everything you heard about in the show in the show notes at the13skulls.com. You know, I really appreciate you guys coming out and listening to the show. I hope you have a happy holidays and a merry, merry Christmas to you all. You guys take care. Have a great day, great night, week, weekend, whatever it is that you're listening to this, and I'll talk to you guys again on another day.